I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is Donna Brazile, a Democratic political operative for more than 40 years. She encountered a firestorm of criticism when she published her memoir of the 2016 election, Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. Many of her fellow Democrats read the book as a bitter diatribe from a disgruntled member of the old guard, but perhaps lost in the scrum of discord were Ms. Brazile's alarming accounts of Russian interference in the electoral process. Yesterday, the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee affirmed the conclusion of multiple intelligence agencies that the Russians did act to support Trump and discredit Clinton in 2016. 2 years later, has anything changed? Marylanders go to the polls next month. Is your vote safe? Donna Brazile joins me right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we get started, the weather is soggy and it is serious. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch, meaning that floods could happen anytime between this afternoon at 2 o'clock here in central Maryland, extending all the way down to Washington, D.C., through tomorrow night. So if you are in a low-lying area, be careful. Folks down Fells Point here in Baltimore, for example, or other places that have had flooding issues in the past, you got to be careful. This weather is for real. It is happening all through the Northeast. So be careful. A flood watch has been issued by the National Weather Service from this afternoon until tomorrow night. So today on our program, we're going to have another installment in a series that we have on political engagement. Primary day in Maryland is just a few weeks away. Early voting begins in less than a month on June 14th. In this series of conversations, we'll talk about efforts to both encourage and suppress voting, and we'll examine how the landscape of candidates in these midterm elections has changed dramatically since the last time voters headed to the polls. Record numbers of women are running for office in this cycle. Next month, I'll speak with Amy Chozick. She's a reporter for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and she covered Hillary Clinton for more than 10 years. We'll talk about the reasons, from her perspective, that Mrs. Clinton was unable to break the glass ceiling in 2016. I'll also talk next month with Jennifer Palmieri. She's the former communications director for Secretary Clinton's failed presidential campaign. She's written a book called Dear Madam President, and it's addressed to the first woman who will break the glass ceiling and become president of the United States. And of course, we're going to continue our series of conversations with the candidates in our effort to help people make informed decisions when they go to the polls. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker, a Democratic candidate for governor. That race, of course, put into very sharp relief and great disruption with the very sudden and unexpected death of Kevin Kamenetz, who, like Mr. Baker, was considered one of the leading people in that race. Mr. Kamenetz died unexpectedly last Thursday. I will speak with Rashern Baker for the hour here in Studio A tomorrow. I'm also going to spend an hour with each of the three candidates who are running for Baltimore State's attorney. And next Monday, Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger becomes the latest congressional incumbent to join us here on Midday. So today, our focus is going to be on the integrity of our electoral process. And my guest is one of the most experienced and perhaps one of the most controversial strategists in modern political history. Donna Brazile is the former chair of the Democratic National Committee. She held that post on two different occasions, once in 2011 and then again in 2016 during the last presidential election. And her 2017 book, which is called Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House, chronicled the Russian invasion of the DNC computer network and their efforts to influence the election. Just yesterday, the Senate Intelligence Committee confirmed that it agrees with the finding of several intelligence agencies that Russia did intervene in the election to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. the DNC has filed suit in the Southern District of New York against the Russian Federation, WikiLeaks, several people identified as Russian hackers, Julian Assange, and members of the Trump campaign, including the president's son and son-in-law. And of course, the investigation of special counsel Robert Mueller continues. It began 1 year ago today. Donna Brazile joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Ms. Brazile, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice. Thank you for having me on.
I know you've been battling soggy traffic in Washington to get to NPR, so thank you for coming in. You are not sanguine about the preparedness of both political campaigns or even local election officials. You sounded alarms about the Russian interference during the campaign in 2016. You wrote a book about it in 2017. And just this month, the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University, where you were a fellow last semester, published a paper about the same things. We are now in the middle of the midterm season. We've had many primaries. Maryland has its primary coming up next month. Are campaigns safe? And are campaigns secure? And is our vote safe?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. We're, as you all know, less than about 185 days from the midterm elections. I still believe we have a lot of work to do in order to protect our elections, to secure them, to ensure that there's no foreign meddling within our system. When I talk about our system, as you know, we have a decentralized form of government. And so our elections are conducted at the state and local level. I'm pleased that the Department of Homeland Security has stepped up their efforts to provide the technical expertise as well as what I like to call the cyber the kind of cyber security that state systems require. But I'm also concerned about campaigns and whether or not they are making cyber literacy and cyber hygiene and cyber security a major focus of their operations as well.
And you did a poll of various campaigns just recently, and you found that most of them weren't doing that.
Well, you know, I've been a campaign manager before at various levels. And when you talk to campaign managers, they're focused on, of course, raising money, increasing the candidate's visibility, reaching out to voters and donors and so forth, stakeholders, communicating with the media. And I kept saying cyber, because you have to protect your data. You have to protect your internal infrastructure that you use to communicate with your staff and donors and others. And if you're not focusing on cybersecurity, your campaign is likely vulnerable to the kind of hacking that we experienced in 2015, 2016 at the Democratic National Committee.
The Senate Intelligence Committee a little earlier this month said that at least six states had their elections websites attacked by Russian operatives leading up to the 2016 election. There's a report on NPR this morning about Knox County, Tennessee, that had its website hacked, and it was down for a while. This is not the website in which people vote. They don't vote online, but this is the website that tells people who's ahead, that you know, announces returns. Is it too late, given the Trump administration's apparent reluctance to really, you know, address this problem head on, is it too late to be fully confident that elections in 2018 are going to be safe?
It's not too late, but I wanted, as you know, as chair of the party, I called for an independent commission to look into 2016. I think most people, especially those on the Republican side, they were worried that we were trying to relitigate the 2016 election. Our concern was the fact that the Russians had been deeply involved in studying our electoral system since the 2014 midterm elections. They were able to look at not just voting patterns, which you can do online, but they really tried to get into the voter registration databases. They were using third parties, these vendors that provide technical expertise to state election commissions and state election boards and secretaries of states. And so my concern was that Congress was going to get into a, what I call a partisan back and forth and not look at the integrity of our electoral process, from everything from how voters register to vote to casting their ballots and how those ballots are counted. We have an antiquated system. Many of our machines do not have paper ballot backups. And while Congress has appropriated funds in the last omnibus bill, we still do not have what I call a robust federal response to the hacking that took place in 2016 and the what I call the ongoing hacking or attempts to hack into our system that continues to go on because the Russians have not given up. And what worries me at night and what should worry most Americans who care about our democracy is that we should make sure that we build a firewall. You know, before the 2017 German elections, Angela Merkel issued a loud call to build an election firewall, and everyone listened. Today, when someone calls for an election firewall, we tend to think of this as a Democratic cry for, you know, bring back the votes of 2016. No, this is an American cry for protecting the integrity of our election process. And Tom, I believe if we don't do that, we're in danger of seeing the kind of hacking that occurred in 2016 happen again and again in our country.
And you mentioned partisanship around an issue that most folks would hope would not be a partisan issue. But what do you make of the difference between the Senate Intelligence Committee understanding of what the intelligence agencies have concluded about Russian interference and the House Intelligence Committee, who basically said, nothing to see here, move on?
Well, I was disappointed, like I hope most Americans, that the House Intelligence Committee did not complete their assignment. They did not look into the quote-unquote raw intelligence that our intelligence agencies used to conclude that the Russians had indeed hacked into our system and that the Russians also had a preference in Donald Trump. And they wanted to discredit Hillary Clinton, who was the nominee of the Democratic Party, and to damage many of the institutions involved. I mean, the fact that they use social media to drive wedges that already exist. They just, made them deeper. So what worries, what should worry all of us is that the House Intelligence Committee swept under the rug a lot of the, what I call the information that was readily available. Instead, they wanted to exonerate the president. And this is not about the president of the United States. He was their quote unquote favorite this time. But who knows which side the Russians will be on next, side of any other foreign government or non-state actor. So I really believe that the Senate Intelligence Committee, along with Special Counsel Robert Mueller, must get to the bottom of what happened so that we can prevent this from happening in 2018, 2020 and beyond.
You and others have analyzed the more than 3,500 Facebook ads that the Russians evidently planted in the last cycle. And you mentioned in your book that the whole campaign was kind of a chaotic circus. Part of that had to do with the style of Donald Trump, very unorthodox and unusual candidate. But there was plenty of disruption and discord to go around in the Democratic National Committee and the relationship between the Democratic National Committee and the Hillary Clinton campaign. And I wonder, your book was very controversial and it really got an awful lot of people on the left very angry about what they saw as, you know, airing some dirty laundry that perhaps should have been taken care of privately. When you write, for example, that Barack Obama, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and Secretary Clinton had stripped the party to a shell for their own egos, that is creating an awful lot of discord as well. At one point in the book, you write that it sometimes seems like Brooklyn, meaning the Hillary Clinton campaign headquarters, wanted to strip the DNC of its functionality almost as much as the Russians did. What did you hope would happen to the conversation when you published that?
Well, first of all, I have been a party activist all of my adult life. I've devoted my entire life to not only engaging people in the political process, I've done voter registration, I've recruited candidates, I've run campaigns from every level, from the local level all the way to the presidential level. I am not a novice when it comes to politics. I love my country. I love democracy. I am a child that will always seek to make our country stronger and better. And so my criticism was not personal. It was constructive because I wanted to let the what I call my colleagues in the DNC, I wanted them to know what happened. We had to come to the realization that the party was essentially stripped of its functions during a crucial election cycle. Here I was chair. I was not a quote unquote staff person. I've been a staff person, so I'm not knocking staff people. I love my staff. I was the chair of the party, meaning I was responsible for maintaining the party during a presidential cycle. What I learned as chair was that in August of 2015, when I served as vice chair, that there was an agreement that went beyond the standard joint fundraising agreement. It was a staff agreement between the DNC staff and the Clinton campaign staff that in exchange for helping the DNC raise money and get out of the debt that the party was in, the Clinton campaign would take over several departments within the party. I wanted to tell this story so that it would never happen again. And I'm working to ensure that it doesn't happen again because I'm going to help with some of the reforms that the party needs to undertake. The other thing I mentioned in the book, and I thought it was important, that we have spent years funneling money to the so-called battleground states at the expense of non-battleground states. When you wake up and it's 2017 and you have special elections in states like Georgia and South Carolina and Kansas and Montana, well, you need resources. But unfortunately, we don't provide those resources in non-presidential years. And so I wanted to ensure that we were able to reform the party. So I put it all out there because I didn't want it said that Donna only wrote about X but didn't write about Y, so therefore we can't get to Z. I put it all out there. And I'm still fighting for the party. I'm still helping to recruit candidates. I'm still working very hard in 2018. I'm not a staff person. I'm not a paid consultant to any campaign, and that's a good thing because I don't have time in my life. But I love my country. I love I love the Democratic Party. And just like before, when I decided to give up everything in my life to become chair for the second time, and to help the party during a very crucial election cycle, I wanted Hillary Clinton to win. I wanted Hillary Clinton to be the 45th president of the United States. I worked very hard for that. Unfortunately, we fell short by less than 78,000 votes, but I also believe that we fell short because not only did we have a headwind, but we also had foreign interference in our election, and that should be on the table when we discuss what should happen in the future.
I'm falling a little short of time. We got to take a break. Donna Brazile is my guest. Last fall, she was a visiting fellow at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University. Earlier this month, the center published her paper about improving cyber literacy in political campaigns. Her book about Russian interference in the 2016 election is called Hacks: The Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns That Put Donald Trump in the White House. When we come back, we'll have more with Donna Brazile. We'll try to take a few of your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the next installment in our Conversations with the Candidates series. Rashern Baker is the Prince George's County Executive and one of eight candidates running for the Democratic nomination for governor, and he'll join me here in Studio A for the hour tomorrow. on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Donna Brazile, a player in Democratic politics for more than 40 years. Her 2017 book and a paper that she's published this month as a visiting fellow at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard chronicle how the Russians hacked the computer systems of the DNC and other organizations and individuals. The DNC is now suing the Russian Federation, certain Russian hackers, WikiLeaks, and several members of the Trump campaign. The complaint cites RICO racketeering statutes, copyright laws, and wiretapping and trade secrets laws. You can join our conversation. We'll try to work in a few phone calls here. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter @midday WYPR. So, Donna, we have an email from Susan, who's one of our listeners, who says, if indeed the 2016 election was affected by outside forces, wouldn't that make it fraudulent? I know of nothing in the Constitution to address this short of impeachment. If the Congress does not act, what then? And if it was fraudulent, doesn't that make every executive decision made since January 2017 also fraudulent? So here's a voter who's, in a way, shoring up what Mr. Trump has been arguing, that all of this Mueller investigation and these lawsuits are nothing but a way of discrediting his administration. As a political consultant, do you think it's a good idea for Democrats running in this cycle, in these midterms, to run on the notion that if elected and Congress flips, they would support impeachment of the president?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that we allow these investigations to continue, that we get to the bottom of what happened. Remember, this was an attack on our country. It wasn't just an attack on the Democratic National Committee or the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. This was an attack on our electoral system. We know from recent press reports that the Russians have also tried to, interfere or meddle with our energy grid. We know that other state actors from time to time, including the Chinese, have tried to meddle in our cyber affairs. As a former federal official, I was appointed by President Obama to serve on the Fulbright board at the State Department. Our personnel files were hacked into. So the cybersecurity is our biggest threat in the 21st century, because we're all connected at some level to the internet, or connected to something that is connected to the internet. And I think it's important that we get to the bottom of everything before we begin to say this one needs to be impeached, this needs to be taken the suit or whatever, because we still don't have all of the basic facts. I still have a lot of questions. And of course, we've seen Mark Zuckerberg and many of the other social media platform officials come before the Congress. We need to have safeguards to ensure that foreign money is not involved in our system. We need to ensure safeguards in terms of our privacy and the content that we share with others on the internet. And I think the most important thing is that state and local officials need to work with the Department of Homeland Security, with the Department of Justice, to ensure that their systems are clean.
But is, we as also a, need but to as have a political our move, as a political strategy, is it a smart play to run on a commitment to attempt to impeach if elected, if the House or the Senate flips in this election?
You know, again, I think it's all based on the evidence. We need to, every elected official, from the president on down to the local county city officials, must be held accountable for their actions. So while it should not be taken off the table if he is accused of breaking the law or committing a crime, we need to figure out what happened. I don't know. I wasn't involved in the Trump campaign. I really wasn't involved that much in the Clinton campaign. I was managing the Democratic National Committee, which was a victim of a crime. And I would hope that the candidates who are running this year, and you're going to talk to a couple of them over the next couple of weeks as we prepare for the June primary in Maryland and D.C. and other places, but I would hope that every elected official pledge to work with those who are investigating this matter to strengthen our electoral system. If any American, anyone worked with, colluded with, conspired with the Russians to hack into our system, to use stolen hacked emails to expose Americans to the kind of harassment that many people I know personally received during this process, I would hope that we would bring them the justice. But that is not the focus of 2018. 2018 should be about our economy. It should be about education. Once again, teachers are walking out of schools today to protest the lack of pay and the lack of respect for the work that they do in our society. Those are the issues that the American people care about. They care about their jobs. They care about education. They care about health care, the rising premiums. There are so many issues to litigate this fall that I would hope that impeaching the President of the United States would not be the focal point, but instead making sure that the American people have what they need to be competitive in the 21st century. That needs to be the focus of our elections.
Donna Brazil is my guest. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Let's go to the phones. Taylor in Roland Park, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom.
This is Taylor. This is Taylor Branch in Mount Washington. Donna Brazil, I'm sure you know Mr. Branch, a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. Welcome to the show, Taylor.
Mr. Branch, I have all of your books. I am one of your biggest fans. I started reading you, and I'm not going to tell my age, but I just started reading your books at an early age, graduating from LSU, so I have the greatest respect for you, and thank you for everything.
Thank you for your book. For most people, hacking is abstract until your credit card gets stolen.
Right.
What I'd like you to comment, because I found it effective in your book, is to describe what it's like to work in an office where it's been hacked, with your relations with your donors and their staff and communication.
Thank you so much, sir. Look, hacking is not fun. You lose access to your entire life. Right now, because of the hacking that I've experienced with Chinese and Russians, I cannot go and get a new account for cable TV. If I decide to change from Comcast to Fios or DirecTV, my credit is frozen, for example. I live on cash, essentially, because it's hard to get a credit card because of all of the attempts to personally my identity theft. When you're hacked along with your staff, people began to harass you online. They begin to appear at your house. They begin to track and follow you because all your personal stuff is out there. And then, of course, they begin to say things about you that are untrue, but they cobble together stuff off the internet that is not true. They impersonate you even on your online message board. I've had to get rid of several accounts that did not have two-step verification process. My Earthlink account, which is my first DSL account. I've had to get rid of even my own personal account for my business because, again, every part of your life is under what I call some form of harassment. And people try to intimidate you, threaten you. And what they did to my staffers, what they did to our donors, they went after them personally. They threatened to kill them, to rape them, to harm their children, to murder their family members. This was not a simple, you know, somebody steal your identity and go home. It really clouded our operations, and it every day we were distracted by the continual attempts to try to harass and to break into our system. It's like having a burglar in your house and you cannot get them out.
In terms of a remedy, the DNC, after your tenure as interim chair, decided to sue these various actors. And I have a copy of the complaint in front of me, and it's a long list of people that they're identifying, the Russian Federation, and then various operatives using the pseudonym Guccifer. These are the people who were the actual hackers. It includes Julian Assange, Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, et cetera, et cetera. Is this, in your view, a realistic attempt for a remedy, or is this just part of sort of political theater, you know, making your points?
Well, before I left the DNC, I wanted to sue all of the above. And at that point, we didn't have enough information, enough evidence. And although we thought that this we could learn more from a discovery, I decided that Tom Perez, who had became my successor. He became the elected chair of the Democratic National Committee. He's a lawyer, worked at the Justice Department. I left this in Tom's hands. Russia attacked our democracy, and a major part of this attack was the hacking of the DNC, stealing proprietary information, and then working with WikiLeaks to unlawfully release it to the public. And they found a willing partner, I think, and some of the officials inside inside the Trump campaign. And we'll learn more about that. The lawsuit is important because we have to find out what happened. And just like the Watergate breach, I know that goes back a long way, the DNC filed a civil suit against the campaign to reelect President Nixon after a member of his campaign was arrested for the break-ins. And the case was eventually settled in civil court for damages. We need to find out everything. We need to find out who was involved. No one sits down with Russian officials in their campaign headquarters space, which was the Trump Tower, to find dirt on the opposition without getting their hands dirty. What else did they find? We need to know everything. And let me say one other thing, because I've heard from some reporters that this is a stunt. No, this is about making sure that our country is never attacked again and people were sleeping at the switch. And when I say sleeping at the switch, you think I'm controversial now? You should have heard me back in 2016 when I was screaming at everybody, help us. I thought the DNC should have went to the Department of Defense and say, help us. We're under attack. And everybody watch. The reporters put it on the front pages of their newspapers. The radio and online social media platforms allow rubles to be used to sow discord. And most of the attacks came directly at Hillary Clinton or those involved with her, from her campaign chairman to her political party. And we need to get to the bottom of it. This is not about a stunt. This is about protecting the electoral integrity of our democracy and ensuring that it doesn't happen again.
And of course, in the case of the Watergate civil suit, the Democratic National Committee did, in fact, collect about $1 million in damages from the Republicans. But that's one thing. It's another thing to expect that the Russian Federation is going to somehow sit down and allow itself to be deposed, or that you could have the same kind of legal remedy. But we'll, of course, see what happens. The Mueller probe is also indicting and trying to bring to trial some of the very same players. But you know, when you talk about the disruption to democracy, it's certainly without doubt that that's what's happened. But the Democratic Party itself, I mean, you write in the book that it was internal bickering within the DNC and between the DNC and the Clinton campaign that led folks at the DNC to take the hacking less seriously than it should have been taken. You write that it took 7 months to respond once you had pretty clear indications that there were problems. The fact that the DNC and the Democratic Party has been disrupted so fundamentally, what's your understanding of how the DNC can be put back together again, how unity and a consensus can be regained in the Democratic Party?
Well, that's a great question. Before departing, I came up with a series of resolutions. And also at the convention, we formed a unity commission made up of delegates from both the Clinton campaign as well as the Sanders campaign. They have provided the party with a great set of recommendations on everything from what we call the administrative functions of the party down to the political functions. Just last week, the delegate selection, the Rules and Bylaws Committee met to look over the delegate selection rules. And we're now implementing many of those administrative as well as political changes that they would like us to see. Next month, we have to deal with the thorny issue of automatic delegates or unpledged superdelegates, whichever name you like to refer to many of us. But we're going to take these recommendations seriously. The party is stronger now. It's a new party. Tom Perez, along with all of the other officers, have not only funded state parties across the country, but we also have internally a chief information, what I call cyber security officer. We have a new chief technology officer. We have a new political director. The party is stronger. And one of the things I wanted to do was to make sure that we left it in a stronger position to be more competitive in the future, but also a stronger party that can deal with the kind of threats that we're going to see in the 21st century to our own democracy and our own election, integrity.
You wrote that the convention, the campaign, the election, had shattered long-term relationships. It's interesting to me that you use that verb. That's, of course, the name of a book by John Allen and Amy Parnes about the Clinton campaign. And you said that, you know, you would hope that the fences could be mended and that, you know, that kind of animosity could be attenuated after the election. We have a listener who wants me to ask you about the Clinton debate question scandal. I wonder, just on a personal level, do you still feel somewhat ostracized by people in the Democratic Party, by the people who did react so vehemently when you had that situation? You mentioned, for example, last year in 2017, you received no invitations to give commencement addresses, and that's the first time that's ever happened to you in 10 years. You're no longer appearing on CNN and ABC. Are you feeling left out of the fold or gradually being brought back in?
Well, first of all, I never felt left out. I felt that, you know, when you have taken on such a big assignment, and I've taken it on twice in my life, you get scarred in the process. It's, you know, politics is not for the faint-hearted. But, you know, I left that campaign season a little bruised, a little battered, but not weary. I'm still a fighter. I'm still engaged. I just pick and choose my battles a little differently now. I've been on ABC now four times. Last year, I was able to get back twice. I'll be back on this Sunday, and I'm grateful for the opportunities to go back on when I can. I've been on MSNBC and Fox, so I get around a little bit. In terms of last year, I did Miles College, but this year I did something even better than a commencement. And I have to tell you, last week, Tom, I was down home in Louisiana, where I'm from, and I was the mistress of ceremony for the first ever female elected to my beautiful hometown. You in Baltimore have a female mayor. In Washington, D.C., we have a female mayor. In 300 years, it took us 300 years to get one in New Orleans. So I'm happy about that. In terms of the debate question, let me say to your listeners, because as you can imagine, when someone attack your credibility and your character, it really gets to the heart of a lot of who you are. And, you know, before writing the book, I did a column in Time magazine, and I said, look, I'm sorry that I had my emails hacked and I could not prove to the world what was true and what was false. But what was true was that at a time the party was under extreme attack, we were being pressured not just from Senator Sanders, but also former Governor Martin O'Malley to open up the debate process, to expand the number of debates. By February and March of 2016, I was deeply involved in that, working with both the campaigns. And yes, it looked as if I was sharing information with one campaign when I was just trying to make sure everybody was on the same page. We were opening it up to different media outlets. We wanted more minority participation. And for the first time, we were going to Flint, Michigan. CNN hosted that debate. And of course, we were going to talk about the water crisis. But I wanted both candidates and campaigns to understand, here's what we're going to talk about. We're going to expand the debates. We're going to expand the inclusion of minority voices, other voices. And we're going to make sure that we get to issues like the death penalty, issues like the water crisis in Flint. Unfortunately, what WikiLeaks wanted you to see was only one side of the picture, anything that would hurt Hillary Clinton. And anybody who knows Secretary Clinton, and I know her very well, the woman is probably one of the most gifted, smartest people I've ever met in my life. I have a lot of admiration for Hillary Clinton. I will always admire her. But I refuse to believe that I was trying in any way to harm another candidate. I was trying to open up the process to everybody.
Right. And I should tell listeners, I have read this book carefully, and you do address that issue pretty thoroughly in the book. Donna Brazil is a veteran political strategist and the former chair of the Democratic National Committee. The book is called Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns that Put Donald Trump in the White House. We'll have more with Donna Brazil when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. Midday at WIPR.org. For an email and a Twitter handle is at Midday WIPR. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, who burned draft records in Catonsville on this very day in 1968. This is music by Joe DiFilippo commemorating that event. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
The sun broke through the clouds on the 17th of May. They gathered in the parking lot, bowed their heads to pray. Father in the heavens, won't you show us the way that we might study war no more?
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest for the hour is Donna Brazile, who served as the chair of the Democratic National Committee during the 2016 campaign. Last year, she published Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. And last fall, she was a visiting fellow at the Shorenstein Center at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She joins us from NPR in Washington. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @midday WYPR. Donna, the lessons that current candidates, down ballot candidates, congressional candidates, state representatives, state senators can learn from the 2016 presidential campaign. You're very critical in the book. You identify things, for example, at one point you call it the cult of Robbie Mook and his obsession with data. You say that data doesn't build enthusiasm. The candidate at the top could have benefited from much more enthusiasm at the bottom. What's your suggestion to the more than 450 women who are involved in this cycle? You also mentioned misogyny in the media as a factor in the race, and you are not alone in that observation. What would you tell those women in places like Pennsylvania and other states that are running in this cycle?
Look, it's important to put together a good campaign. That is the number one goal. But ultimately, campaigns are about people. They're about reaching out to people where they live, where they eat, where they play, and where they pray. I got involved in politics at the age of nine because I had something, there was something I wanted, something that I thought the community wanted. That was a playground in my neighborhood. And I went to my parents, I went to my relatives, I went to my neighbors, I went to everybody and said, please register to vote, because if you vote, we can get a playground. And I think politics has lost a lot in these last few decades because it's now about how much money you raise, how many insults you can hurl at your opponent. We're no longer talking to people about the things that matter in their lives. I mean, if you look at the participation level in our country compared to many other Western democracy, we are down. We're down almost 25% across the board. And in non-presidential years, turnout sometimes is so small that it's crazy. I had a friend recently tell me she had in her precinct in Fort Worth, Texas, only 7 people showed up, and it was 6 o'clock in the evening when she cast her ballot. 8 people. I mean, we need to take our democracy a lot more seriously. And it's about people. It's about giving people a reason to hope and to inspire them. That's what politics is all about. It's not about people going out there and making a boatload of money and caring about, you know, if they're going to be rich and famous. You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, I may not be, you know, on the number one list. But what list I'm on? I'm on a list of people that have fought to make a difference in the lives of others. A person who went out all her adult life to register people to vote, to get people excited about their democracy. I'm proud of that. And that's what I teach my students, whether they're at Harvard or Georgetown or Rutgers or University of Maryland College Park, where I served for a number of years. I want the students of tomorrow to learn the lessons of yesterday so that they can make a difference in their community and their country. Politics is about people. Be yourself, be authentic, and go to the people with hope. Give people something to hope for. That's what politics is all about.
What should Democrats be hoping for in 2020 when you had to face a possible decision of replacing Secretary Clinton on the ballot because she had that health scare when she attended the 9/11 memorial in New York? You had to think about that. You ended up not having to do that, but you thought about it. And at that time, you write that you liked the Biden-Booker ticket. Joe Biden as president, Cory Booker as vice president. Is that the ticket for 2020 that you're supporting? recording, and do the Democrats need a ticket? Do they need a person, a candidate, the way they had in Barack Obama to you know, congeal around in order to regain the unity that they seem to have lost in this last campaign?
Well, I have to tell you, by my count, we're up to about 52 or 53 people who are interested in running for president. So we are going to have a wealth of great candidates with a lot of things to say to the American people. I'm very excited about 2020. But before we can get on board with a candidate, we should get through 2018. This is a big election cycle. As you well know, three quarters of the American people will be choosing their governors. That's important. We also have all the American people will be choosing their representatives. And with a record number of retirements and people moving on, this is a big year for women. I hope that the pink wave will create a blue tide, a pink wave led by women who are finding their seats at the table. They have found their voices. I'm excited about what happened in Pennsylvania. I'll be in Pennsylvania tomorrow night, right outside of Philadelphia, inspiring women to keep moving, to keep running for office. And, you know, we're going to have a good year only because the American people still believe in change and they still want quality candidates who will represent them, whether it's in the halls of Congress or in City Hall.
In terms of the Democratic National Committee, the reason you became the interim chair was that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was accused of playing favorites, of favoring Secretary Clinton over Mr. Sanders and, to a lesser degree, Mr. O'Malley. Can the DNC, or the RNC for that matter, be scrupulously fair all of the time? Is that the function of the Democratic National Committee? You've said just a few minutes ago on this program that you wholeheartedly supported Hillary Clinton. Did you come to that determination only after she won enough votes in the primaries, or did you, if you harbored that thought during the primary season, why be involved with the DNC? Why not simply work for Hillary Clinton if that's the one you wanted to win?
You know, Tom, back in 2008, people accused me because I was black of supporting Barack Obama, and then some accused me because I was a woman of supporting Hillary Clinton. And I said, no, I'm really getting old and tired, and maybe I'm supporting John McCain. I didn't have a favorite. I like Bernie. If you go back and look at all of the transcripts from CNN and ABC, I defended Bernie, I defended Hillary, I defended Martin O'Malley, James Webb, and Lincoln Chafee. My job as a party official was to defend everybody. Do I know Hillary? Absolutely. I've known her for over 30 years. Not as a staff person. I've known her because she has been indispensable and outspoken advocate for children and child health care. That's why I know Hillary Clinton. And like I said, I respect her. But no, I did not put my hand on any lever. The DNC is fair. The DNC staff, I concluded after going to each department and talking to all of the senior staff, that the DNC was as fair as you could possibly get. The chair made the decision on the six debates. We opened up the process. The chair made the decision on many other factors in terms of the joint fundraising agreement. You know, I criticized that because the staff should never get involved in that process. But in terms of where we are today, it's a stronger party. It's being led by good people. I respect Tom Perez and the staff and what they're doing. I believe that the party is going to emerge stronger for 2018 and 2020. As you've seen all of the seats that we flipped over the last couple of months, the party is stronger. And we have a lot of people to thank for that, including Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who put together the Unity Commission to ensure that we can reform and strengthen the party in the future.
I have 20 seconds to ask you that. Are you concerned that we have too many candidates? There are some races in which there are, you know, 6, 8, 9 Democratic candidates that are diluting the message and diluting the power of any individual Democrat to challenge effectively whoever the Republican nominee is.
My simple answer is no. Politics is about participation. And the more people we get excited to run for office, to go out there and engage the voters, to get them excited about their future, that's what politics is all about. We should not be coronating anybody. Let everyone run. I want to hear from all of the candidates. And at the end of the day, it's my vote and the vote of others that will determine the outcome.
Donna Brazil, her book is called Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-Ins and Breakdowns That Put Donald Trump in the White House. She has been a visiting fellow at the Shorenstein Center, the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard on two occasions, most recently last fall. Earlier this month, the center published a paper she wrote about Russian hacking of the 2016 election and the inadequate preparation on the part of political campaigns and government entities to prevent interference like that in this year's election cycle. We've got a link at WIPR.org/midday. Donna Brazile, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Hope we talk again soon.
Thank you, and God bless you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. I'll spend the hour with Rashern Baker, the Prince George's County executive who's running in the Democratic primary for governor. Hope you can join us then. We want to thank Dangerously Delicious Pies for lunch. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find them on the web at dangerouspiesvault.com. Today is the first day of Ramadan. If you are beginning your fast, Ramadan Mubarak. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.